Here's the story of my first love. I don't usually tell it all at once because it's a really long story, but I will try to condense the 13 years down a little bit. This is a list of firsts that happened to me over that time, in chronological order.
From Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming.
First crush. First date. First time telling someone I like her. First unrequited like. First time persisting anyway. First kiss. First epistolary romance. First girlfriend. First love. First time buying a ring. First time asking someone to marry me. First time getting married. First time getting walked in on by a cleaning lady in the honeymoon suite while in various stages of undress. First time having sex. First apartment together. First vacation together. First time failing at Valentine's Day. First fight. First anniversary. Second time failing at Valentine's Day. First signs of trouble. First difficult conversation. First marriage counseling session. First time losing hope that things would ever get better. First time deciding to leave. First time breaking someone's heart. First separation. First divorce.
That's independent producer Whitney Jones. In this hour, after the romance.
The opening line for many couples is, "We love each other very much. We have no sex."
Couples therapist Esther Perel.
Many, many expressions around inhibitions, prohibitions, fears, shame, guilt, longings, yearnings that pertain to desire. That's a set of issues that people bring in relation to the erotic dimension of their relationship.
You're talking about pain in many of these cases, severe pain that these people are feeling. How do you get from there to passion?
Actually, people come because they yearn to connect to that dimension of their life, to that passion, to that eroticism, if you want. And eroticism not just in the modern sense of the word that has narrowed it to just sex, but eroticism as a quality of aliveness, of vibrancy, of vitality, of energy. People today have located sexuality in desire. Desire as a feature of an individualistic culture. So it speaks to my autonomy, it speaks to my freedom, it speaks to my sense of self-worth. And so the most oft presenting problem around sexuality today is the crisis of desire.
This is relatively new, isn't it? I mean, this goes against many of the things that in Western culture, anyway, we've been taught about the security of long-term relationships. We rarely talk about sex as part of a relationship that lasts for a decade or two or four.
Well, the story in the West, if we were to really make it very succinct, would be a 150-year story, right, where major changes start to take place. Marriage used to be for economic sustenance. It was a partnership for life that was meant to give us companionship and children and succession and social status. And then we brought love to marriage. And we began to change the word intimacy from a companionship for life to a recognition of the self by an other who validates me and reflects back an image of myself that helps me transcend my existential aloneness. Then we brought sex to marriage, which comes with, first and foremost, the democratization of contraception, then with the gay movement, both of them challenging the power dynamics in society as well as introducing the concept of sexual identity. And with that, the first thing that changes is that sexuality is no longer just relegated to the world of nature and biology, kind of part of our condition. It becomes now a feature of who I am, part of my values and my identity. And then we connected marital happiness with sexual satisfaction. Today, we want the same person to give us security and adventure. I want to reconcile with you my needs for safety and security and stability, and I want also to have with you mystery and transcendence and awe and novelty. I want you to give me comfort and edge, excitement and familiarity. It's a fantastic paradox that we are trying to manage.
Well, and it's also asking a great deal of everyone involved. You want me to tell you everything about myself. I want to know everything about you. We are too much together. How do you maintain excitement in that kind of union?
Well, there are two parts to that. We are asking today from one person to give us what once an entire village used to provide. We may not be more insecure today, but we definitely are bringing all our insecurity needs to one person. And in our efforts to secure love, we often will trample the passion. If the verb that accompanies love is to have, the verb that accompanies desire is to want. Love doesn't want secrets. Love wants to narrow the gap, to neutralize the threat, it wants closeness. But desire needs space to thrive. It likes the unknown. It likes the unexpected. It likes mystery. If desire is fueled by the unknown, then faced with the unknown in our midst, we can have two primary responses. Either I'm anxious, either I become curious. If I'm anxious, I'm going to close up. I'm going to create something that is fixed, reliable, and don't surprise me. And I'm going to complain of marital ennui and boredom. If I'm open, then I kind of am able to see you and to see the persistent mystery that is in my partner. And then I can actually play with this wonderful formula that passion is commensurate with the amount of uncertainty that we can tolerate.
I'm curious, I guess you talk about the paradox of the necessity of aloneness, of separateness in relationships. Where does that paradox find its answer?
So the way I've come to understand it, and from listening to many, many people, is that desire needs a bridge to cross, a certain emotional distance that allows me to come and visit you. Sometimes people confuse intimacy with fusion, and there is not enough space anymore to go and visit or be visited by another person. Another way of saying it would be to say that love and desire, they relate, but they also conflict. And herein lies the mystery of eroticism.
You want to get to know each other, you want to know more, but you also want to remain separate in order to maintain the mystery.
Or you never know the person that is next to you. In fact, that's an existential reality. When people, you say it like that, and they say, what do you mean? I know my partner, I've been living with them for 20-something years, and so forth. So I began to play with this question that I've asked pretty much the world around, which is, when do you find yourself most drawn to your partner? And all over the world, people are responding to me with a set of answers. When we've been away, when he's away, when we reunite, basically emphasizing the aspects of longing and absence. And the second part of answers have to do with when I see my partner on stage, when I see my partner in his passion, in her element, competent, confident, radiant. Basically, when I look at my partner from a comfortable distance, not 5 centimeters from each other blended into one, and not that far away that I can no longer see their contours. Then you have the notion of the uncertainty. The idea that we want to think that love can be secure is probably something that makes God laugh. The vulnerability of love is that we can always lose. And so, in fact, once you accept this idea that your partner doesn't belong to you, then you actually shield yourself from that pseudo-transparency in which you think there's nothing left in between us to discover. And if there is no discovery and no exploration left, then where does the desire come from?
Do you see this changing as years go by? Do you have younger people coming to you with different attitudes toward this?
No. What I'm seeing is people who lose their desire much sooner. That's the phenomenon that's emerging. The younger the people are, the faster their desire leaves their relationship. And that's because we are coming up with a whole generation that has often been raised on not experiencing frustration. If you don't experience frustration, if you have immediate gratification, if when you're bored with something you just need to delete and click away, then you are not a good candidate for sustaining desire in the long haul.
What do you think this means then for relationships, for marriage over the next 50 years?
Well, one of the things we know that is happening is that if monogamy used to be one person for life, at this point in the West, monogamy has become one person at a time. We also know that in a culture, the ones in which we live, we are exhorted constantly to satisfy our desires. It's not like we have more desires today than we had before, but we are compelled to satisfy them and encouraged to do so. There is going to become many new models, I think, of coupledom, in which people will try to create spaces to experience that freedom with each other or sometimes with others. Until now, we have one model, and when the model collapses, people divorce, basically. I think what we're going to see more and more is a multitude of new models. To last, they will need to be flexible. To reinvent themselves, they will need to be flexible. And to meet the multitude of needs that people bring today to their romantic relationships, they will need to be flexible and creative.
Esther Perel, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Esther Perel is a family and couples therapist. Her book is called Mating in Captivity. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. There are no hard numbers on how many people are in open relationships, but it seems like something more and more couples are considering once the first flames of passion cool. An open marriage may sound like an artifact of the swinging 70s, but Tristan Terramino says you probably know someone in an open relationship. You just don't know that you know. Terramino is a sex educator who wrote the go-to manual on open relationships. She told Steve Paulson there are many forms of what she calls ethical non-monogamy.
Anywhere from swinging to people who are polyamorous and have multiple partners who they have love and sexual relationships with, to people who have a primary partner and then may have just sex partners on the side.
Why do so many people want to engage in some sort of open relationship?
Well, I think for some people, it's simply because monogamy doesn't work. I mean, monogamy may be this revered and sacred institution, but as a relationship style, it's really pretty dismal and has failed a lot of people. So people are looking for an alternative. And there are people out there who say, I don't want to cheat. I want to be honest about this. And how can we create a relationship and a set of guidelines that incorporate other partners and do it in a really responsible way?
That is quite a statement to say that monogamy is basically a dismal model, considering that the vast majority of people are ostensibly in monogamous relationships.
They are, but they're not succeeding very well. I mean, we know that half of all marriages end in divorce. Some statistics put cheating at a rate of 60 or even 70% in someone's lifetime. So cheating is pretty rampant. And I think that that really shows us that monogamy isn't necessarily the best model for everyone, although it seems to be the default model that everyone ends up in and then they're stuck there.
It's the default model because that is the cultural standard, that, you know, sort of the definition of a successful relationship is you find one partner and stay with that person forever.
Yeah, I think that that's what we are brought up to believe. We're brought up to believe that it's the mature choice. And when you're truly in love with someone, you want to be monogamous with them because you don't want anyone else. And that's just not true for people. You know, there are a lot of people out there who believe that you could love more than one person at a time. And other people who believe you can love someone strongly, commit to them strongly, and still have other sexual partners that doesn't infringe on your primary partnership.
I would think jealousy would be such a common issue that people would have to deal with once you are in an open relationship. How do people sort that out?
Yeah, I think it's very difficult. You know, it's not true that people in open relationships aren't jealous. The majority of the people said, I absolutely feel jealous, and it's something I have to grapple with on a regular basis. And I think that's part of what you sign up for when you sign up for an open relationship. You're going to have to confront some of your own emotional baggage around insecurity, fear of abandonment, envy, possessiveness. An open relationship is not a good idea to fix a monogamous one. It's you've got to have a solid foundation before you open up.
Well, I've known a few people who have undertaken open relationships, and they've decided, okay, we're going to try this. In fact, not that long ago, two very good friends announced that they were going to do this. They'd been married for years, and within 6 months, one of them had moved in with someone else, had a new partner. That soon became the primary relationship, and they are now getting divorced. Is that a common story?
Well, it's a common story of serial monogamy, actually. This is what I call the Newt Gingrich style of non-consensual open relationships, which is I take a mistress and then I divorce my wife and my mistress becomes my second wife. And then I take another mistress, divorce my second wife, and my mistress becomes my third wife.
But in this case, they were both open.
They were both open.
And they were upbeat and excited about the prospect. But then I think what happened was, you know, one person got involved in another relationship, and that became the primary one then.
One of the things that people do in open relationships is they really have to manage that new relationship energy. When you first get infatuated or excited about someone and everything about them is really amazing, and you're like, hey, let me pack up all my belongings and move in with them. There's a time at which you have to take a pause and say, let's not make any abrupt decisions here, because this little honeymoon phase of feeling high and in love or in lust is going to come to an end. And if you can ride out that wave, then you can make better decisions, I think.
Are you in an open relationship yourself?
I am, and I just celebrated 12 years with my partner.
Wow, 12 years. How do you think about that? I mean, are there ground rules or expectations in terms of, you know, what, how to do it and what not to do?
Yeah, I think that's one of the most important parts of it, is really sitting down and saying what feels okay and what is a total deal breaker, so that everyone has a sense of being respected and feeling secure. And in the 12 years that I've been with my partner, I have definitely explored different styles of open relationship. And it's really about communication, 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 and being able to once in a while own up to your own insecurities. Because I think I'm in a place now where if my partner wants to go have sex with someone else, I don't think that that's any comment about me. I think it just has to do with my partner wanting to have sex with someone else. And I don't internalize that. And I actually appreciate that my partner can go and have experiences that maybe he can't get with me.
Have you always felt this way? Or is this something you had to work at to get to that point where you would not feel threatened?
Oh, yes. Certainly my first open relationship, which was in college, was a disaster. I mean, there were like tantrums and bad boundaries galore. I think this is a constant learning experience always. And at the core, I believe in this. And I want to give my partner the freedom to explore all that life can bring us. And so when I remind myself of that, and I remind myself of our commitment and how we have stood by each other through all these years, a little slap and tickle on the side just doesn't seem like that big of a deal.
You know, we're talking about some pretty heady ideas here. Relationships and the nature of romance and monogamy. Is this really sort of ultimately, though, about sex?
Sometimes it is. You know, there's certain people in the polyamorous activist movement who really want to stress that this is about love relationships and commitments, and it's just loving and committing to more than one person. But for some people, it is just about sex. It's about sexual variety, and it's about sexual diversity. And that's okay.
Of course, the obvious question is, if you are part of an open relationship, is the sex better outside of your primary relationship?
Well, that is, you know, $1 million question. And if I answer that question, then all the marriage counselors in America will be losing money. But what I will say is, when you're in a long-term relationship, sex does change. you're not in that honeymoon phase. Your hormones are not pumping at just extraordinary volume. You don't want to rip each other's clothes off the minute you get home. So the truth is, can it be more exciting to pursue and have sex with someone who is, first of all, different than your primary partner and new to you? Absolutely.
Well, you know, we haven't really talked that explicitly about marriage. Is it harder to be in an open relationship if you're in a marriage, given all the sort of the cultural expectations of what comes with marriage?
That is an interesting question, because going into this research for this book, one of the sort of preconceived ideas I already had about people is, if they are doing such a radical thing as challenging monogamy, many of them probably are anti-marriage. And in fact, I found that the majority of people who could get married were married. So people in open relationships, I think, are really interested in redefining marriage more than throwing it out altogether. I don't think that you can necessarily assume, just because someone's married, that in their vows to each other or in their conversations with one another, that they've agreed to sexual fidelity.
Go into the chapel and we're gonna get married.
That's sex educator Tristan Teramino. Her book on open relationships is called Opening Up. We're tweeting about her and the rest of our guests. If you want to follow us on Twitter, the handle is TTBook1. Coming up...
Single people aren't the lonely, pitiable souls that we have historically considered them to be. And if you are single, there is so much potential in a life that's unfettered by another.
But first, maybe your romantic relationship is solid. You can't imagine life without your sweetheart. You want to build a future together, grow old together. You want to be married. So you pop the question, book a hall. Simple, right? Not if it's not legal for you to be married. After nearly 3 decades together, Brian Kaufman and Martin Swinger recently got hitched. On the first day gay marriage became legal in the state of Maine. And Strange Champs asked them all about it.
Congratulations on your wedding. I hear that you have a great proposal story.
Well, yeah.
Thank you. It was more interesting than I expected it would be.
How did it happen?
Once we realized that we even could get married, Brian started saying, wait a minute, aren't we supposed to get engaged first? How do you do that? Neither of us ever even expected to get married in the first place. So
were you like, which one of us should kneel?
A little bit, but Brian kind of took that one on.
Well, I thought if we were going to get married, if we were going to do it and do it the first day that it was possible to in the state of Maine, that we should have some kind of good proposal story to tell, some kind of romantic setting or an exotic experience. So I started thinking about what might be a good way to do that. And I came up with a good scheme, and I didn't tell Martin the details about it.
It all started with a restaurant that I work in a small town in Maine. The town has a Christmas parade every year. It's sort of a joke that it's the shortest Christmas parade because the town is only 5 blocks long. So the restaurant I work at always participates. And so we were brainstorming what to do and decided that we would just decorate the truck and basically ride in the back of the truck. But the waitresses wanted to wear some kind of costume. So they talked about dressing as superheroes. Brian took that superhero seriously, and what he came up with was...
Well, sure. When I get an invitation that says, put on your party dress and come to a party, I take it seriously, even if it means I might be the only one wearing a dress at the party. And I thought, I'll be Captain Pretzel, because long ago we found this wonderful 3.5-foot-wide styrofoam pretzel that someone had crazily discarded in the trash. And I thought, I'll just put on my Christmas cape and a nice festive little hat that I found in Chinatown once and carry my pretzel. And Martin also put his Christmas cape on. And the Christmas capes basically were 70% off Christmas tree skirts that we found at TJ Maxx a few years ago. But we thought, gosh, this looks pretty darn festive.
I'm trying to imagine what kind of proposal is going to come out of this.
Oh, well, the Christmas parade ironically happened to be scheduled for the first night of Hanukkah this year. And the candle lighting represents illumination, enlightenment, and intelligence and freedom in the world. And I thought, what better night to propose in the Hallowell Christmas parade? So I ended up being one of the riders in the back of the owner's pickup truck. And we were all kind of precariously perched in the back. Martin was walking behind the truck, and I was waiting for the right moment to actually propose to him.
So you were going to propose in public in the middle of town from the top of a float in the parade?
I thought that would make a good proposal story. Well, Martin kept saying, don't you dare propose at work. I'm working at the restaurant tonight. Don't you dare interrupt me. Okay.
So why not in front of the entire town?
Well, yeah. That was less stressful, frankly.
Yeah. So
what did you do?
Well, I realized that all of a sudden we were nearing the end of the very, very short parade route. And that if I didn't propose immediately, there would be no opportunity. So just before the truck made a turn to go up a steep hill, I said, Martin, on this first night of Hanukkah, in the spirit of the freedom from oppression, will you marry me? And just at that point, the driver turned the truck up the hill. The truck popped a gear. We all kind of got thrown in the back of the truck. My arms flung open and my enormous pretzel flew out of my hand and kind of sailed right at Martin. And he dove for it. And I didn't hear if he responded or not.
So meanwhile, because I was not on the truck, I grabbed the pretzel and was running back the four blocks to meet everybody, the whole time laughing at, well, here's my engagement ring. It's a big styrofoam pretzel. I don't think either of us expected that to be the situation, but Providence stepped right up, and so my engagement ring is a styrofoam pretzel.
Well, after a proposal like that, I really want to know what the wedding was like. Did you have a big public wedding?
Yes and no. Growing up gay, we are confronted with all the rules that we're supposed to follow, that couples are supposed to follow, and yet at the same time we're excluded from being allowed to follow those things. So pretty early on, growing up gay, we sort of realized that we get to make our own rules. So when it came to the idea of having a wedding, we really felt like, you know what, we're going to do this our way. So what I did, since I work at the restaurant, I know that Saturday afternoons tend to be a lull. And so what we decided was on December 29th, the very first day that we could actually apply for the license, that we just put the word out to friends saying, if you'd like to attend our wedding, meet us at the bar at 4 o'clock in the afternoon.
Especially because the owner of the restaurant had also been a staunch supporter of civil rights and equal rights. We thought it would be fun to include her and the staff. Everyone in town really was so supportive. We thought, why not let them share in this wacky, crazy moment that we never thought was going to happen in our lifetimes?
I'm curious, when you were making your vows to each other, and you know, there's that moment at the very culmination of the vows when the officiant says, I now pronounce you. Did they say man and husband?
I think we were husband and husband.
I think she said husband and husband. I mean, you know, after 27 years, we know each other pretty well. Somebody said, are you going to do your own vows? We both said, nope, we're going to sing a song. And we've got a favorite song from a production called Whoop-Dee-Doo, and the song was called I'm Stuck on You. We both knew that that's what we needed to do for our wedding. So we sing this crazy song, I'm stuck on you like lint to a sweater, like stamps to a mushy old love letter, baby, I'm stuck on you. And it was just, we knew that's what we had to do.
So I have to ask, you guys have been together for 27 years, so there's no doubt about your commitment to each other. Why was a legal marriage important to you?
Well, at first, it wasn't. At first, I was thinking, you know, marriage has really not been the model institution. There are so many problems with it. So many people are unhappy. We thought we should wait for something better to come along. But when this happened, when we did win the right to be able to be married, I started hearing, oh, yes, my best friend and his husband, or my neighbor and her wife. When I started to hear people say things like that, I thought, this is amazing. This is crazy. 10 years ago, who would have thought that you'd hear sentences like this? For all the years that Martin and I have worked on civil rights, on advancing equality, as long as there would be the opportunity afforded by the legislature, by the voters, by our neighbors, by people who really believe that we should have the right, I thought, you know, we're already practically married. Why not just kind of do it?
And another thing is, all through our relationship, we've never had a word for each other. I refer to Brian as my partner. And that means so many different things to so many people, and it's often been confused. And the only way to be specific and honest, husband is really the word that says everything that anybody needs to know to understand what our relationship is.
Well, Brian and Martin, we wish you a long and happy marriage.
Thank you very much. We've got a lot more celebrating to do.
That's Brian Kaufman and Martin Swinger talking with Anne Strangechamps. In case you're curious, Brian's a psychology professor. Martin's a singer and songwriter. Here's one of his songs for Brian.
He's telling me, you take one step, I'll take two. Isn't it strange what two people do when they try? Holding on, you and I. Holding on.
I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. You might recognize Kate Bollock. She was on the cover of the Atlantic magazine in late 2011 with a banner in bold white lettering that read, "What, me marry?" Her article about all the single ladies, herself included, spread like web wildfire, sparking discussions about the demise of the desirable male, the rise of the happily single woman, gray divorces, and a whole lot more. Well, since then, Bollock's continued to research, write, and talk about the state of romantic unions. She told Anne that despite a growing number of women putting off marriage, most university-age women still think they'll be married by 27. She's got to break the news to them.
The news is you will most likely get married, but probably not when you're 27. You'll probably do it in your early 30s. The age keeps trending upward, And it's not because of a dearth of men. It's because your sense of drive and ambition is going to take you further than you can imagine it doing right now. So back when I was in college saying, oh, of course I'll get married by 30. First, I want to go to graduate school and start my career, and then I'll fall in love and do that. And, well, actually going to graduate school and starting my career was really exciting and really absorbing, and it's what I wanted to keep doing. I wasn't ready to settle down with a mate, and I did not anticipate that. That's what I think is different, in that it's surprising to me that that kind of news hasn't yet caught on. And can it? Will it? Or is that desire for family and mating so deeply ingrained, and that expectation so deeply ingrained, that your 20s are going to be a surprise no matter what?
Well, I mean, let's talk some about your own personal experience. You were deeply invested in career and graduate school and all until 30. And then was there a moment when you suddenly looked around and thought, okay, I'm ready to get married and settle down now?
Well, that happened for me last year at 39. But up until then, I kept thinking I would find someone and get married. It didn't occur to me that I wouldn't. I'd been in love before. I had had long-term relationships. It did surprise me in my early 30s that I hadn't done that yet. And then the big surprise was at 35, realizing, oh, I'm not unmarried because something's wrong with me, or because I'm making selfish decisions, or I'm immature and can't settle down, or because there are no men. I'm single at 35 because I haven't wanted to be married yet, and I've kept making that decision to not be married. I just have not had that desire. And
so it wasn't that all the guys you were dating were jerks.
No, I was dating wonderful guys. I was involved with several very commitment-minded men who it was clear that should we go in that direction, that's where we would be going together. And once it started going closer to that direction, I felt like, wait a minute. I don't want to go in that direction I'd with anybody right now. I don't know why.
And so it sounds like what you're saying is we grow up with this cultural idea that happily ever after means getting married and settled down. And you just kind of had that as a construct in your head. But in fact, what your life and your real choices was telling you all along is that that really wasn't your dream.
Exactly.
So is it still not your dream, or do you want to get married?
Well, as I said last year, I had this kind of premonition moment. I was out at a restaurant with a guy I was dating at the time. I can't believe I'm admitting this on in public, but I did have this kind of mystical moment where I thought, oh my gosh, I want to be married, and not to this person, but I'm ready for something. And what it meant, what that meant to me, or for what marriage has meant to me all along, is that it's an extreme commitment, and it requires a lot of engagement and agency and generosity and being present to, and responsible to another human being in a way that I just didn't think I was capable of it yet. And it's also meant to me a kind of narrowing of my world. And I wasn't ready for my world to narrow. I loved being alone in the world and accumulating many experiences. And what I felt in this strange, mystical, premonitory moment was, I've had enough experiences now. I'm ready to slow down a little bit and reorient myself.
That's just such an interesting thing to hear you say. You're the woman who wrote a very famous article on essentially the virtues of being single, you know, sort of positing this new kind of world in which we might be able to embrace a happily ever after, in which you'd stay single forever.
Well, if you notice in the article, I never say that I'm actually against marriage, and I never say that I don't actually want to get married myself. What I am saying is that being single is a completely legitimate way to exist, and for me, a very absorbing and interesting one. Once I made that realization, I was much happier inside of my life. Mm-hmm. And when I look back at the last 15, 20 years, I have been very satisfied with it. The only thing that was making me unhappy was the idea that I should be doing something else that I wasn't doing.
Right, right. And what are you finding amongst other women? Because you're doing a lot of research, a lot of talking to women of many different ages. Have you met many women who, in fact, are deciding to stay single, are happy with that state?
Yeah, I am meeting women who are deciding to stay single. They're not overwhelming numbers. They tend to be older. Usually, if a woman is 40 and unmarried, that's when she comes to this conclusion that, like, actually...
Well, there's that famous factoid or whatever, what, after 40, a woman has as much chance of being hit by lightning as married?
That's that horrible Newsweek article,
I think,
from the 80s.
Yes, I hope that's not true.
It's not true. And in fact, I forget what the statistic is, but numbers show that most people get married eventually. Mm-hmm. And the more educated you are, the more you push off marriage is another statistic, but you still get married. And the older you are when you get married, the more likely it is that your marriage will not end in divorce. What I tend to find is that women in their 40s who have never been married are saying, yeah, I went through a phase where I wanted it and I thought I was going to have it and I was upset that I didn't. And then I turned some corner at some point where I realized that I was actually incredibly happy with my life and my work and the way that I'm living right now. And so if I've wanted anything to come out of this article conversation, it's that I've wanted there to be a more positive conversation around what it means to be single. Single people aren't the lonely, pitiable souls that we have historically considered them to be. And my message is not stay single forever, down with marriage. It's if you are single, there is so much potential in a life that's unfettered by another. Enjoy that time while you have it.
Is there a process of mourning do you think that people have to go through in order to let go of that happily ever after married fantasy?
Oh, that's a wonderful question. I think yes. I think I did.
Really?
Yeah. And I mean, I write about it in the article, and it's true that when I was 35, I was breaking up with yet another boyfriend. It had been a year we'd been together. I had felt very seriously committed to it, but had come to realize that we really weren't suited for one another. Once I'd realized that we had to break up, I went to sleep that night and had a dream in which my mother, who died in 1996 and very occasionally emerges in dreams, never to give me advice. And this is the first time. And I said in the dream, "Mom, oh, I'm breaking up with him tomorrow. I'm really sad." And she said, "Oh, honey, I know. We were really feeling good about this one, weren't we?" And I said, "Yeah." She said, "Well, you know, if it doesn't work, it doesn't work. And so it's just time to move on." And I said, "But Mom, I'm getting old." And she said, "Oh, God, you've got 6 more years." And I really did. I woke up and I was like, "Oh, right. What am I so freaked out about? I have a little more time. Like, I don't have to go just marry someone because I'm supposed to. What's going on? What kind of craziness have I absorbed?" And the kind of mourning of that idea was what ending that relationship was about. You know, maybe this is my last chance at the kind of traditional way of doing things. And it made me really sad to think that I wouldn't have that. But oh my God, I have been so much happier ever since. Just once you reach the other side of a kind of mourning, that there's a clarity there and a liberation that you couldn't have anticipated.
You said that you'd recently gotten to the point where you thought, "Yeah, I do want to get married." What if you hadn't gotten to that point? You know, if you were still the Kate who's decided, "No, I really like my single life." Can you kind of paint a picture of what your life would be like?
Yeah.
You know, moving on into the future.
It's funny. This is a complicated thing to describe, but the fantasy of always being alone is a really appealing one to me. In my own fantasy of my own eternally single life, I just see myself doing exactly what I'm doing now, I guess, just more and more years of it, that I'm very excited by my work, traveling, you know, continuing to share my life with my close friends who have been with me all along and making new friends. And yeah, I guess I just see a life of eternally being single as being exactly as it is right now.
And that's not lonely?
It's not lonely. That's not to say I don't experience loneliness at times. Of course I do. But I think we all experience loneliness, even when we're married. And also keep in mind that this kind of marriage revolution that we are witnessing, in which people are getting married later and less frequently, we're also, you know, in the midst of this gray divorce revolution, they're calling it, where divorce rates for those 50 and over have doubled over the last 20 years. So we are spending more time alone at every chapter of our life. And again, it's why it's so important to understand what being alone and being single means, and really recognizing that it can be a very positive experience if
right.
you make it that way. Because
right. we really need to stop seeing it as a form of failure.
Exactly. And again, like, you know, our other kind of way of thinking about single people is that they're selfish. This wasn't about selfishness. It was about not seeing myself simply as a romantic appendage to somebody else.
That's Kate Bullock. Her Atlantic cover article is called "All the Single Ladies." If you want to hear about her research at a Dutch community built just for single women, check out the extended version of this interview at ttbook.org. Before we go, the last word on After the Romance goes to the person behind this hour, producer Sarah Nix. Hey, Sarah.
Hey, Jim.
What have you got?
Well, in my opinion, there's a silver lining to the end of any romance, and that's the soundtrack, particularly the angry breakup songs. They're a kind of surefire way to bust up the post-breakup blues. So I asked Robin Lynn and Jason Saldana, their producers at Sound Opinions, which is a great public radio program out of Chicago, to come in and talk with me about angry breakup songs. What do you guys think makes for a good breakup song?
Lyrics are probably the most important thing. You obviously want to say something that hurts the other person as much as you possibly can. And tone of the song is also important, whether it's juxtaposed against some happy music or some dire music.
Yeah, I would echo the tone and second that with attitude. Some of the songs I was thinking about, you parse the lyrics and they're not that complicated or even that biting. It's the delivery that really packs the punch.
Yeah, I agree. And I have to admit that looking through what you guys had sent me or listening through what you'd sent me, I loved anything with a really angry guitar. It was very satisfying.
Yeah, yeah, certain instruments are not going to give you the fire that you want. I don't know that I've heard angry cowbell. Guitar is a good go-to.
Well, okay, let's get started. Let's go angry, because I have the sense that when your heart's broken and you're kind of maybe ready to be over it, at least for a couple of songs, you want an angry breakup song.
Of course.
And it feels like there are three genres, right? Blame, revenge, and I'm moving on. So let's start with blame.
Okay.
Jason, you had a great one from Outkast.
Yeah, this is a song from probably their breakout album, Stankonia, in 2000, 2001. And it was, I think, the first single, actually, Miss Jackson.
Yeah, this one right here goes out to all the babies, mamas.
Andre 3000 is talking about a breakup with, actually, Erykah Badu.
Baby, mamas. I'm sorry, Miss Jackson. Ooh, I am for real. Never meant to make your daughter cry. Baby, it's drama, mama. Don't like me. She be doing things like having the boys come from her neighborhood to the studio trying to fight me. She need to get a piece of American pie and take her bite out. That's my house. I disconnect the cable and turn the lights out and let her know her grandchild is a baby and not a paycheck. Private school, daycare, shit, medical bills, I pay that. I love your mom and everything. See, I ain't the only one who lay down. She wanna rip you up and start a custody war. My lawyer, stay down. She never got a chance to hear my side of the story. We was divided. She had fish fries and cookouts for my child's birthday. I ain't invited. Despite it, I show her the utmost respect when I fall through. All you do is defend that lady when I call.
So great.
Yeah, it's a wonderful song. It's actually Big Boy starts the song, and then Andre 3000 comes in later and talks about his relationship with Miss Badu.
Yeah, I was wondering if the call to the baby mamas in the beginning was actually a call out, straight out to Erykah Badu. Sarah, I suggested her song Tyrone too. It's actually, I would say, my ultimate breakup song from her 1997 live album, and it's the audience that sells it.
Sisters, how y'all feel? Brothers, y'all all right? Okay. See how y'all groove today.
It starts off sort of a sultry R&B song, and you think she's going to come in with some sort of bedroom tune. And then the lyrics come in, many of which are not radio-friendly, but she's hilariously sort of sending up her loser boyfriend. And the titular character, Tyrone, isn't even her boyfriend. It's her boyfriend's loser friend.
Well, let's hear just a little bit of it. It's so great.
See, every time you come around, you got to bring Jim, James, Paul, and Tyrone. See, why can't we be by ourselves sometime? See, I've been having this for a long time. I just want it to be you and me, like it used to be, baby. But you don't know how to act. So matter of fact, I think you better call Tyrone.
You know what I love about this is that she sounds so sarcastic and exhausted at the same time.
Yes, she's much funnier lady than you might believe just by listening to her other albums. And the real punchline is at the end. You know, she continues, you better call Tyrone, and has the backup singers come in, call him, but you can't use my phone.
What do you do after that? Why don't you just leave?
Yeah. Okay, let's move on to Revenge now. So I asked some of our listeners for their favorite breakup songs, angry breakup songs. Mm-hmm. And lots of people said Song for the Dumped from Ben Folds 5.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
But somebody else suggested this one that I don't know anything about Shellac. Do you guys know about Shellac?
Oh, yes.
Hometown Heroes.
Yeah, Shellac is the band from the famous record producer Steve Albini. And he is very noted for his acerbic nature. I remember I bought this record. It's called 1,000 Hertz. And this track opens 1,000 Hertz. It blows you away because you can't believe somebody was so angry.
To the one true God above, here is my prayer. Not the first you've heard, the first I rode, not the first, but the others, were a long time ago. There are two people here, and I want you to kill them.
He doesn't really pull punches, does he?
No.
But just so we don't give Steve Albini too bad of a rap, he made it out on the other side. He has a pretty interesting blog, actually, that's just recipes that he does lovingly for his wife.
No, really?
And it's just, like, dinners that he prepares lovingly for her, so.
He got past the revenge. Robin, you had a really good one that I liked a lot as well. From Love?
Yes, My Little Red Book, which is their cover of a Burt Bacharach Hal David song. So I love Arthur Lee's take on it, who was the lead singer of Love, from 1966. Because it goes sort of from angry to pathetic as each verse, chorus, and verse moves on. You know, he's singing, the minute you left, I got out my little red book and I just thumbed through it and I just picked out all the girls and I'm going to forget about you. But of course, then the chorus comes in, but all I did was talk about you and hear your name and I'd start to cry.
It's angry to pathetic, just like revenge so often is.
Yep. If literature has taught us nothing, it's that revenges are always tragedies, right, Sarah?
Yes.
They don't end well.
Okay, well, let's move on from revenge. Let's move on to moving on. Robin, you had a really good one about this, too.
The Avalanches. This is a group from Australia. Their sound is dominated by collage and by a lot of samples. And the song Since I Left You is pretty much just one line. The soundscape underneath it is really lush.
Get a drink, have a good time now. Welcome to paradise, 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 paradise.
What I love about it is it's just so gleeful. After a breakup, you just want to run outside and spin around and just keep repeating, the world is better since I left you, and I want everyone to know it.
One thing I really like about that is that it makes the new world sound like it's full of swimming pools and
yes,
beautiful people and cocktail lounges. It's a great moving on song.
It's very uplifting, I agree.
Thanks, you guys.
Thank you.
Robin Lynn and Jason Saldana are producers at Sound Opinions. And they are, by the way, happily married to one another. Our producer, Sarah Nix, talked with them. And if you want to hear an extended version of their conversation with more breakup songs, find us online at ttbook.org. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. You can buy a copy of this program by calling the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for After the Romance. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour was produced by Sarah Nix, with the help of Ann Strainchamps, Charles Monroe Kane, Doug Gordon, and Veronica Rickert. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson. Our technical director is Kirill Owen.
PRI, Public Radio International.